This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show, inflation is back on investors' radar. We look at the turmoil it's already caused.
You know, until last week, markets were happy to digest this prospect of stronger economic growth, higher inflation, higher earnings, because it was against this backdrop of ultra low interest rates. But this sudden rise in yields has somewhat spooked equity investors.
The amount of inflation investors might expect.
We will see headline rates of inflation going up to 3% or 3.5%.
And the threat it poses to assets.
When inflation starts to really creep up, when you see inflation going above 3% on average and starts rising from those levels, that's where equity investors are potentially in trouble.
Inflation or rising prices poses a stealth threat to investors.
We haven't seen inflation in a generation, so a lot of people forgot what it looked like. We've got a lot of stimulus coming down the pike. We've done a lot. We've just passed $900 billion. We're talking about another $2,000 a month, and we're talking in the Biden administration about even more. Then we've got a vaccine coming, and we've got a return to normal. Once you get all of that into the pipeline, you could have a burst of economic activity that could produce higher inflation for the first time in a generation.
It chips away at real returns, whether it be investments or savings, if they fail to keep up with the rate of inflation. Inflation happens when demand for goods outstrips supply. In the US, it's often described as too many dollars chasing too few goods. Moderate inflation is associated with economic growth, while high inflation can be a signal of an overheated economy. But should we be worried about inflation? The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, a common measure of inflation, was 1.4% in the US in January, well below the Federal Reserve's 2% target. It's been there for a while now. And the pandemic has kept most major economies in some form or another shut down over the last year, leading to higher levels of unemployment. Hardly an inflationary environment yet. To spur a recovery and repair the economic scarring caused by COVID-19 over the past year, central banks have continued to pump huge amounts of money into the economy.
This is a massive move by the Fed coming into the market in a very big way. I believe that's $1 trillion. I believe that's in addition to what they're already doing. Flooding the zone is understated.
Governments continue to support businesses and furloughed workers.
The furlough was the right policy at the time we introduced it. It provided immediate short-term protection for millions of jobs through a period of acute crisis.
And the success of vaccines brings the prospect of a return to normal ever more closer.
And finally, provided we continue to pass the four tests, then from the 21st of June, we will go to step four and say goodbye to most remaining restrictions.
Which could lead to the release of a huge amount of pent-up demand. And we're already seeing some of that being reflected in markets. The lesser-spotted bond vigilantes, which are bond market investors who protest monetary and fiscal policies considered inflationary by selling bonds and thus increasing yields, have been out in force in recent days. The oil price has risen above $60 from a low of $30 in May, and money growth in the US has just hit 25% in 2020, its fastest rate on record. And that's not to mention the rising cost of food prices. We have been warned. So in this show, Keith Wade, Chief Economist, and Sean Markowitz, a strategist on the research and analytics team, join me to discuss what impact that might have on markets and how real the threat of inflation is. But in the first part of the show, we're going to look at the three routes to higher inflation.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
Keith, you wrote an article right at the end of last year, "Is Inflation Coming Back? Three Routes to Higher Prices." I just wanted to go through those three routes one by one and see if they still apply now. So firstly, you had inflation could already be higher. It's not just being it's just not being measured properly. Can you explain what we mean by that?
The inflation is measured by the CPI, which is a fixed basket, which is based on surveys of how people do their spending. And COVID has rather changed that basket of spending. You know, obviously, we're continuing to spend money on food, but we're not spending money on travel or leisure or entertainment.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close. We're also telling nightclubs, theatres, cinemas, gyms and leisure centres to close on the same timescale.
A serious but moment. The weights in the inflation basket have stayed the same, and so those service sector areas have seen quite a lot of weakness, and their prices will have come down as a result of the pandemic. But we're not consuming those goods. So inflation will be depressed in those areas where we're not really spending money. So in some ways, inflation is not being measured properly. And, you know, we're ending up seeing food prices rise, for example, and that's not probably being given the weight that it should be given in the normal CPI. So it's a bit of a technical answer, but in terms of what people are seeing in terms of their spending basket, inflation may actually already be a bit higher than being measured.
Okay, that makes sense. And the second one was households go on a spending binge. Can you explain that one for us?
Yeah, so of course, part of this not being able to spend on other things means that people's savings have gone up. So if you look in the US, you can see that savings rate has gone up to nearly 20% now.
46% of folks describe themselves as more of a saver compared to prior to COVID. Only 13% say their monthly spending has gone up. Not sure on what. Almost half say they have decreased spending. The top reason, concern about the current economic situation, followed by losing a source of income other than a job.
And it's a similar story here in the UK and across Europe and around the world. You know, people have been in lockdown or restricted, so you know they haven't been able to make their usual spending. So as the lockdown gets lifted, people will want to go out and spend that excess savings. And we can see this in the money supply numbers. We can see that, you know, bank deposits have risen very sharply. So that could be seen as kind of latent demand. And, you know, once the lockdowns are lifted, people rush out and go and spend. So that could be inflationary. And that could mean that, you know, there'll be too much money chasing too few goods. That's the sort of classic cause of inflation. That's the second route.
Yeah, there'll be a few people hearing that and thinking to themselves, well, how's that happening during a pandemic when so many people are facing unemployment? So how or why has the amount of money that people save gone up?
Well, it has gone up because a lot of people have been able to carry on working, or they've been on furlough schemes. So they've been receiving, say, 80% of their wage here in the UK. Or in the US, they've been receiving paychecks directly from the government.
First, let's take a look at how dependent households have been on government transfer payments, all kinds of income support programs. And you see, it's gone from this long-term average in the high teens, shot up toward 35% at the very peak of the shutdown back a few months ago. And then as of August, the latest reading we have, it's down under 25%, but still very elevated in terms of how much of personal disposable income is now represented by those government transfer payments. So this would imply if they start to continue to go away, unemployment checks, things like that, then...
So they will have that money, but I think the point that you make there about the threat of unemployment is a very good one, because one of the reasons why I'm less concerned about inflation going forward is I think that people will still be cautious when the lockdowns are lifted. So, you know, although they have got this savings, they may be able to be thinking, well, you know, a lot of uncertainty in my industry now, even after the restrictions are lifted. We know that people won't be able to go out and spend in exactly the same way that they did before. There's been a lot of changes in terms of the use of, technology, or whether or not people are commuting anymore. So all those changes, I think, will mean that people will stay quite cautious for a period, and that they won't just rush out and spend. So although people are saying this is going to create a huge binge and a huge boost in spending, I think there will be an improvement in spending, but it won't be the kind of inflationary boost that some people are talking about.
Okay, and the third one, so we've just spoken about the buying side of it. You're saying there could be a supply side shock. Can you explain that one?
Yeah, I mean, this is what economists call the scarring effect. So, you know, the long run effects from the pandemic. And it really comes down to those sort of shifts that I was talking about. So, for example, if after the pandemic we decide that we're going to carry on shopping online at a much higher rate, as we have done. So, for example, in the UK, one in three goods now is bought online compared to, say, well, it was less than one in five before the pandemic hit. Say if that high level of internet usage and shopping continues, that will mean that retail areas will decline. You'll see unemployment increasing in the retail sector, and you know that means that, you know, people may become long run unemployed. So what my concern is that the this shock to the economy means that we have a long run impact on what we call the potential growth in the economy, and that we see pockets of unemployment being created that are very hard to reduce. And the danger that has for inflation is that as policymakers and central banks look at the economy, they'll see this unemployment and they'll think, oh, there's lots of spare capacity. We can keep policy loose. But it turns out that some of that spare capacity can't be used anymore. And that means that policy is too loose. You end up with too much demand, too much inflation. That's the third kind of route that you could get to higher inflation.
So those are the three potential routes that we picked out to inflation. In the next section of the show, we'll look at what it means for investors.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
So in the past week or so, we've had a little mini rout of the bond market. We've also had a bit of fluctuation in stock markets as well, some of which has been pinned on the fears that inflation could be about to rise. So, Sean, how might inflation impact markets?
Well, what we saw unfold in the previous week was a combination of two things. I mean, on the one hand, we had the expectation that growth is likely to be better than expected. And we saw the yield adjusted for inflation pick up. So that was actually a positive. But because of the way that equity prices are valued, it meant that it was actually perceived as a negative in the market. And I think to truly explain what's going on, we need to understand how both bonds and equities respond to inflation. So when we think about what the sensitivity of these asset classes are to inflation, we need to think about, you know, where do they get their cash flows from? So to start, I think it's worth explaining that, you know, bonds, for quite obvious reasons, are an immediate casualty from high inflation because they have a fixed stream of interest payments that become less valuable as the overall cost of goods and services accelerates. And when that happens, yields rise and bond prices have to fall in order to compensate investors. But if we're talking about equities, they actually have a much more complex relationship with inflation. On the one hand, in theory, if you have a rise in prices, that should correspond to a rise in nominal revenues and boost share prices. But on the other hand, this may be offset by a contraction in their profit margins, given that increase in the company's input costs. And what we see in practice is actually that the impact of inflation on earnings will vary by economic sector and their ability to pass on those higher input costs to end consumers. If you take energy companies, for example, they might have more pricing power than, say, an electronics retailer. But regardless of the industry, as long as those input costs don't increase at the same rate as revenues, that rise in profit margin should be translating into greater nominal earnings. Now, here's where the issue is. The problem is where the market will start to discount those future earnings at a higher rate. when inflation rises or when inflation expectations rise. And that's what we saw unfold a bit somewhat last week.
There was something that happened earlier today that kind of spooked equities investors. They saw that 10-year Treasury yield spike 0.2% to over 1.6%. And then, as you said, it did settle back down, but it's making investors really, really nervous. And they've had their eye on these rising bond yields, but now they're getting especially nervous. The thing is, if you look historically,
when that happens, those cash flows are going to be worth less in today's money. You know, all else being equal, the higher the level and the level of inflation, the greater the discount rate applied to those earnings, and therefore the lower the price to earnings ratio investors are prepared to pay.
Sorry to interrupt. Just a quick explainer. The price to earnings ratio indicates the dollar amount an investor can expect to invest in a company in order to receive $1 of that company's earnings. It's sometimes referred to as the price multiple because it shows how much investors are willing to pay per dollar of earnings. So if a company was currently trading on a PE of 20 times, the interpretation is that an investor is willing to pay $20 for a dollar of current earnings. In theory, the lower the multiple, the less highly valued a company is. Back to the show.
And it's really that net impact, I think, of higher expected nominal earnings versus higher discount rates that determines how equities behave in these environments of potentially higher inflation expectations. And with that mechanism unfolding last week, we saw a large rise in bond yields, a sell-off in equities, because, you know, until last week, markets were happy to digest this prospect of stronger economic growth, higher inflation, higher earnings, because it was against this backdrop of ultra low interest rates. But the sudden rise in yields is somewhat spooked equity investors, I would say, of potentially what's in store further down the line if inflation and yields were to really take off.
Okay, so we think that inflation has a chance of rising. So which assets have offered the most consistent inflation protection?
So there are different ways to measure inflation protection. I think the most appropriate measurement is really whether the return generated by the asset class that investors own beats inflation. So that's to say that the return on a yearly basis surpasses or exceeds the level of inflation in that period, because that's what they really care about, generating a return that is higher than the level of inflation so that they can generate a real positive asset class return on their portfolio. But that's not going to be constant over time. Different economic environments will shape how asset classes behave. So some assets might do well when inflation is low and rising, but they might not do well when it's high and rising. Equities fit into that category, I believe. So there's a widely held belief equities are an effective inflation hedge. And indeed, historically, when you look at the data, at least when we crunch the data, the sweet spot for equities has been quote unquote low and rising inflation, which we would define as periods where inflation is increasing, but it's below 3% on average. And that's where we are today and have been for most of the past decade. And it's during those periods that we found that U.S. equity returns beat inflation around 90% of the time. So their returns exceeded the rate of inflation. But if you take bonds, for example, measured as U.S. treasuries, they were nowhere near as good. They posted around a 57% success rate. But when inflation starts to really creep up, when you see inflation going above 3% on average and starts rising from those levels, that's where equity investors are potentially in trouble. At least according to history, in those environments, equities underperformed inflation half the time. So that's to say they posted a negative return adjusted for inflation around 50% of the time. Meanwhile, you take another asset class such as commodities or U.S. real estate investment trusts, so vehicles that track the real estate market, they came out on top in those environments. They outperformed inflation around 83% of the time and 67% of the time, respectively. And that makes sense. The commodities, what are they? They're raw materials, they're energy costs. They're a source of inputs for companies, and they're also a key component of inflation indices. So by definition, they're going to do well when inflation rises. And similarly, real estate assets, they also offer some partial inflation hedge because they can pass through any of those price increases in rental contracts and property prices. I think it's also worth mentioning how the inflation-protected fixed income market reacts, because that's another area where investors often seek refuge. So U.S. TIPS, U.S. Treasury inflation protected securities, they adjust their coupons and principals based on the level of inflation. They actually displayed a somewhat disappointing success rate of 63%, so outperforming only 63% of the time in high and rising inflation environments, which surprised us when we looked at the numbers. And you know, one possible explanation for that is because over these short holding periods, so we looked at a year-to-year analysis period, it's possible that the price impact of the movements in inflation-adjusted yields can dominate any of that inflation-linked income that I mentioned. So if you take, for example, the 10-year Treasury inflation-protected security today, if their yields were to rise by 1%, just 1%, that would impose a mark-to-market loss of 7% on those kind of bond investors. And then finally, I just finalized with gold. You know, gold is often touted as a hedge against currency debasement fears, but actually the track record isn't great. You know, when we looked at the high and rising inflation environments, it actually beat inflation only 64% of the time. So that's less than real estate, that's less than commodities. And I think one possible explanation for that is, you know, the driver of gold isn't really inflation. It's more about, I'd say, the level of real yields, because, you know, gold, unlike many other asset classes, it pays no income compared to, say, safe haven assets such as bonds. And that's because there's an opportunity cost to investing in gold when your money could be earning a yield elsewhere. So when real yields, so that's the yield adjusted for inflation, approaches zero, goes negative, which is where we are today, then the opportunity cost of owning a zero yielding asset such as gold decreases. So, you know, when in the past, when inflation has gone up, we've seen real yields potentially increase as central banks try to fight that inflationary environment. But there's a possibility that, and so gold would do less well in the environment, there's a possibility that doesn't happen this time as central banks try and keep monetary policy easy to avoid a double dip recession. And in that environment, gold might actually prove to be a good investment.
Okay, so I'm an investor, and I think that inflation is going to go up. Interest rates are probably going to start to rise as well. What price will I be paying as an investor for some inflation protection?
Well, some of the asset classes that I've described have already been taken advantage of by investors. So I mentioned Treasury inflation protected securities. They're already looking quite expensive with real yields deeply negative as they currently stand. I mean, we've seen an increase in real yields from last week, but from a historical perspective, they're still at all-time lows. On the other hand, they're also quite stable compared to other asset classes from a return perspective. Their historical returns have been materially less volatile. And I think that's one of the things that I think investors need to be considering in terms of, you know, what price are they paying? It doesn't have to be a literal price. It can be something that they'll need to pay in the form of a trade-off for their portfolio, because incorporating these inflation hedging assets into their portfolio isn't going to be a free lunch. One of the things that could happen is it could increase their portfolio risk profile. And the two asset classes that I'm thinking of are real estate investment trusts, real estate being quite a volatile asset class because it's publicly traded, at least if you buy a REIT. It's going to fluctuate with the best public equity market. Commodities as well, they tend to have quite volatile risk profiles. And even though that comes in exchange for potentially more portfolio protection against inflation, that trade-off, I think, needs to be considered. And ultimately, whether it does increase the portfolio volatility, it's going to depend on, you know, do those assets have a high correlation with other assets in an investor's portfolio? So I think investors need to be thinking about, you know, what do they currently already own? How do those assets behave with the asset classes that they're considering increasing exposure to? As, you know, all else equal, the lower the correlation that those assets that they're considering have on the inner portfolio, the bigger the reduction in risk. So these are the types of implicit costs that I think investors need to be looking carefully at and should be factored into their asset allocation decisions.
Okay, so plenty for investors to be thinking about. But in the final part of the show, we're just going to look at how likely inflation in the future or the very near future might be. So, Keith, you set out your three routes to inflation in the first part of the show. In your own mind, how likely is it that we will see higher inflation in the short term?
Well, in the short term, we're going to see higher inflation. I think that's pretty certain. And that's really because of the rise in commodity prices. So the pickup in oil prices from last year and the pickup in food prices that I mentioned earlier, those are quite big components of CPI-NC. So we will see headline rates of inflation going up to 3% or 3.5% around the world as a result of these base effects. But those should prove to be temporary. They will be washing through the indices as we go through the year. So by the end of the year, they won't be having the same kind of impact. So this is just a one-off effect. There would perhaps be a further increase in inflation as the economies reopen. There's a lot of uncertainty about service sector pricing that I talked about earlier. So when businesses reopen, they may have extra costs involved in allowing more social distancing and so on. If you think about the previous reopening of the economy, many retail outlets or hairdressers or pubs or what have you, you know, they had to limit their capacity because they couldn't go back to normal. And there's a cost in doing that. Their productivity is less. So there is some extra cost in that. But what we need to distinguish is whether or not a one-off increase in prices leads to a persistent increase in inflation. And there's a big difference between the two, because if it's just a one-off, it will just fall back. If it's going to be persistent, then that really is a problem for investors and markets and interest rates. And central banks have to react to that. So what are the kind of things that could cause that persistent rise in inflation? Well, it would really mean that the labour market would start to change and you'd see quite a big increase in wages. So the one-off increase would lead to a more permanent increase in costs as wages go up, and that would then be inflationary. And that's the kind of inflation that I would be more concerned about. My own view is that we don't get that increase coming through. I think there is a lot of slack. There's a lot of unemployment. I think there will still be quite a lot of caution. And I don't see those second round effects, as we call them as economists, I don't see those really beginning to come through and create persistent inflation. You have to remember that before COVID hit the world economy, the puzzle for economists was, why were wages so weak and why was inflation so low? And I don't think that those forces that created that environment have really changed enough to make us think that we will get persistent inflation. We still have, you know, global forces on prices. We still have technology pushing down prices. And worker bargaining power is still quite weak. So I still think that we'll get a one-off increase in inflation, but then it will fall back, and then we'll go back to the more sort of modest rates of inflation that we saw pre-COVID.
So how do you think governments might react? Because they seem to be walking a little bit of a tightrope at the moment.
Well, governments may well welcome a bit of inflation. And actually, a lot of central banks will welcome a bit of inflation. Because again, you've got to look at what was happening before COVID. If you looked at the US, for example, the Federal Reserve undershot its inflation target of 2% persistently for more than a decade. So after the global financial crisis, inflation was tended to average about 1.5% in the US rather than the 2% that it was supposed to. So a bit more inflation would probably be quite good. And then if you look at the Eurozone and Japan, they would also welcome quite a bit more inflation because they have been hovering around deflation. And in many ways, deflation is more of a problem than inflation because it means that the value of debts increases in real terms and that becomes more of a drag on the economy. So there would actually be a little bit of a welcome to see a bit more worker bargaining power and a little bit more wage growth coming through and a little bit more inflation. I think it's a question about how far that goes. And I guess that's where the tightrope comes into it, because you know, a little bit of inflation wouldn't be a bad thing. But if it really took off, and say if inflation went to 5 or 6%, then that could become problematic. And, you know, the reason why central banks targeted inflation in the first place was because higher inflation is actually quite unpopular with people. If you think about people on fixed incomes, if you think about people living off their savings, in a world where interest rates are very low, they can't get compensated for that. And that means that they, in real terms, they'll be worse off. They'll find that their spending basket is more expensive and they'll effectively be poorer as a result. So it is a bit of a tightrope, but I feel that inflation expectations in the world economy have become very well anchored. And this is what economists look at when they're trying to think about whether or not inflation is becoming too high. If inflation expectations begin to pick up, then you will see greater demands for wages and you'll see wages beginning to pick up. And so far, there's no sign of that. But that's the variable that I would really keep an eye on as to whether or not we can stay on this path of keeping inflation around about 2% and not too high and not too low.
So if we are in for a period where there is entrenched inflation, how might markets react?
I think that is the risk that we're facing here. The central banks have been pretty clear that they want to look through the pickup in inflation that's being generated by commodity prices. It's very similar to what happened during the global financial crisis when a big rise in oil prices went up to $100 a barrel, pushed headline inflation up to 5% in the US. But the Fed focused on the core rate of inflation. They stripped out that rise in oil prices and they could see that underlying inflation hadn't picked up. And once the oil prices stabilized and began to come down, headline inflation fell very, very sharply. So the key thing will be whether or not the market is prepared to buy into that outlook and see that inflation actually is only going to be temporary and it's not going to become more of a permanent feature.
Here's what else investors are talking about. London has returned to top spots in the Schroders Global Cities Index after scoring highly in its response to climate change in comparison to other cities in the index. Cities in the Schroders Global Cities Index are scored on four metrics: economic, environmental, innovation, and transport. The ranking identifies cities with a combination of economic dynamism, excellent universities, forward-thinking environmental policies, and excellent transport infrastructure. This year, the index has introduced a transport score into the ranking, with a particular focus on mass transit systems. As a result, Car-reliant Los Angeles falls from first place last year to 14th position now. You can read the full article by Mark Herlihy at schroders.com/insights, where you can find all of Schroders' articles. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, you can go to schroders.com/the investor download. There you can listen to our back catalogue and read related articles. If you want to contact us about anything in the show, email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.